Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
Okay, so when you're talking about teenage mommies, teenage fathers, the expectations are totally unrealistic. They don't understand that when this kid starts walking around, their toddler age, you know, you need to take everything in your house that is breakable that you love and put it in the attic until the kid turns 16, because otherwise it's all going to break, right? You know, they don't understand that. You've got to do this. You have to do this. If you love, if you know, there's something that you care about, sure. They don't understand that when you go to cook something on the stove, don't keep the handle out, turn the handle in. Something as simple as that. They don't understand that. So it's a very, very difficult thing, and it's a huge challenge for you all to deal with adolescent moms and adolescent dads as well. You want to encourage them to take prenatal vitamins, to get prenatal care. And a lot of times, the only way you can get them to take the vitamins and to get the care is not to talk about the baby, but to talk about them and focus in on them, because that's all they care about, really. They're still at that point in time where that's what they care about. So, you know, it would be better for your health. It would be better for your, you can get your figure back right, you know, faster if you do this. You see, you have to turn it so that it's focused on them, not the baby. They care about the baby, but it's still an unrealistic, a very unrealistic sort of an idea. You want to definitely teach them about labor and delivery. You want to teach them that it hurts. Okay, I had a 14-year-old in labor screaming, "It hurts, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts. Do something, it hurts." And I said, "Yeah, I know it hurts. That's why they call it labor, not picnic." You also want to teach them about infant care, okay? Taking care of the baby, that's such an important thing. Teach them simple stuff like, what do you do with the umbilical cord? All right? How do you bathe the baby? Yes, pick the baby up. You know, mommy says, don't pick the baby up. You will spoil the kid. No, pick the baby up. Baby has only one way to tell you there's something wrong, and that's from crying. And so when the baby cries, pick him up. Find out what's wrong. Because he's guaranteed it's either because he's hungry, he's wet his diaper, or pooped in his diaper, or he just wants you to pick him up. That's all. It's one of three things. Very easy. Very easy. But if you don't know the expectations and you don't know this about babies, what happens? Then you know, you end up with child abuse cases. All right, let's talk about labor and delivery. This is, I know you all been waiting all day for this, huh? Okay, we're going to talk about the passenger, the passageway, the powers, the placenta, and the psychological response. Hey, we're going to have some fun here. Okay, let's talk about the passenger, which is the fetus. Remember that the fetus, the largest part of that baby is the head. Yes, the baby is all head, isn't it? It's all head. So the largest part is the head, and this head must be able to pass through the pelvis. The position is the relationship of that presenting part to the maternal pelvis. Okay, so you all know about LOA, ROA, LOP, ROP. Okay, I'm going to stand up here now. I'm going to be the fetus. Okay, I'm the fetus. I'm going to go into this little fetal position now, right? Here I go. I'm in this little fetal position. Now, if I am LOA, that means I'm in this position. My occiput is on the left side of mommy. Yes? And I am now looking at my mommy's right butt. See? I'm LOA. Got it? This is left. This is right. I'm fetus. I'm in the fetal position. I'm in this position, LOA, left occiput, this is my occiput, left side of mommy, anterior, this is the anterior portion of mommy, this is mommy's butt right here, okay? So my left occiput is this way, anterior, and I'm looking at mommy's right butt. Now, ROA, I am now ROA, right occiput, occiput's in the right side of mommy, anterior, and I'm looking at mommy's left butt. Got it? Sure. Now, I can't do the other way because I'm not double jointed, but you get the idea. Okay. All right. Okay. The presenting part is the part that enters the feet, enters the pelvis, and you've got the cephalic, which means head first, you've got the breech, which means feet first, and then you've got shoulder. Now remember, with breech birth, it's really important that when those legs come out, that you got to get the head out pretty quick before the cervix snaps shut. Okay? Like I said, these perinatologists were incredible. This one doctor was amazing. She's absolutely incredible. She could deliver the baby, and you know, the feet would come out first, breech, and she'd just go pop, and here the baby would come right out, and then the cervix would clamp shut right behind it. Because you don't want the cervix to clamp around the baby's throat, especially breech presentation. So she was very, very good. So the problem and the concern with the breech presentation is not only getting the feet out real quick, okay, but getting the feet out and then getting the head out real quick before the cervix clamps shut. Okay, so that's a really important thing. There's a thing called Leopold's maneuvers, and you all know this. Leopold's maneuvers is when you palpate the abdomen, the examiner palpates the abdomen of mommy, and you can palpate and feel for the fetal heart and the bottom, and then you can also feel the arms and the fingers. So you're essentially determining position with Leopold's maneuvers. You can also do it by vag exam. Of course, you would have to have ruptured membranes to do this. And what you can do is if you put your fingers up during a vag exam, and if she's somewhat, she has to be dilated as well, okay? At least 2 centimeters dilated. So she's about 2 centimeters dilated. You can put your fingers in and kind of feel if there's a feel for the suture line and the fontanelles, and then you can tell whether she's ROA, LOA, or whatever. But she has to have ruptured membranes. Okay, fetal assessment during labor. Well, you've got to monitor those fetal heart tones. And we do this through external fetal monitoring. We can do it through internal fetal monitoring as well. We can do it also from fetal blood gases, but we generally do fetal blood gases after birth, and we take the blood gases right from the umbilical cord. We don't do fetal scalp sampling anymore, though NCLEX still asks you about it, but we really don't do that anymore. And we do watch those fetal heart patterns a whole lot so that we can monitor also for fetal distress. Okay, let me go ahead and put this low-tech projector up so we can talk about fetal heart tones real quick. Do you all know how to tell? This top diagram here, this top bump here, that's mommy. Okay, that's the mommy's contraction, all right? This one down here is the fetal heart tone. So essentially, this is a good picture because this is an early deceleration. The deceleration of the fetal heart rate should coincide with the mommy's contraction. In other words, when mommy contracts, when she reaches the peak of her contraction, the baby's heart rate should reach the lowest it was possibly going to reach. This is an early decel, and this is good because it shows that the baby is simply responding to the contraction. Okay? If you have a condition of late decelerations, that is not good, and that means a problem. That indicates some form of a problem. If you have decelerations that don't pay any attention at all to mommy's contractions, in other words, there's absolutely no correlation at all, that's big time trouble, and we'll get into exactly what each one means in just a second. Okay? Now, when you're counting contractions on mommy, because you don't count baby's contractions, baby stuff, but you do count mommy's contractions, okay? If you're counting frequency, in other words, how often these contractions are occurring, then you're counting from the beginning of one to the beginning of the next. If you're counting duration of a contraction, then you're counting from the beginning of one to the end of the same one. If you're counting intensity, then you're measuring this level. Okay, so how high and how intense that is. All right? The normal fetal heart rate is what? Between 120 and 160. We like those things. If it's less than that, we have a little bit of a problem, and we get kind of nervous about that. Okay, here's what we like to see during labor. Very happy babies. The fetal heart rate should be 120 to 160. We like beat-to-beat variability, which simply means that fetal heart rate should have squiggly lines on it. Okay, it shouldn't be smooth. It should be squiggly. So beat-to-beat variability is very, very good. Okay, the other thing that we like to see and we want to do is we want to put an external monitor on mom. So we put a tocotransducer on the mommy's fundus, and we can also use a fetoscope. And a fetoscope is something that has, it looks like the stethoscope, but it's got a big, the actual bell of the stethoscope is right, you know, from is on your head. So we can use a fetoscope as well to determine the fetal position. The other way we can do it is by using an internal scalp electrode. Now, for us to utilize an internal scalp electrode, which means we actually hook it onto baby's scalp, is obviously she must be dilated at least 3 centimeters, and she must have ruptured her membranes, because otherwise we can't feel the baby. And we're certainly not going to rupture the membranes. And the fetal head should also be engaged, because that's the only way we can actually ascertain. Okay, so if the fetal head is engaged, cervix is 3 centimeters, we'll go ahead and put a fetal scalp electrode in. So I talked to you about fetal blood gases, and I said to you that we generally do that from the umbilical cord. And essentially what we're trying to find out after the fact, if there was any acidosis at all, and if there wasn't, the baby might have been hypoxic for certain periods of for a period of time in utero. We want to watch for fetal heart patterns, and I just went over early D cells and late D cells. Okay, early decelerations are good; they're very reassuring. It simply means that there's a head compression on the baby. A late D cell can occur late in the occurs late in the contraction, and it indicates the possibility of a uteroplacental insufficiency. In other words, there's not enough oxygenation getting through to the baby. So it's a UPI, or uteroplacental insufficiency. Late D cells, if you see them, you turn the mommy over onto one side, give her oxygen, and if she's on PIT, slow it down. Okay, so that's how you take care of late D cells. Variable D cells, which I told you we did not like, we really hated that, that's umbilical cord compressions. There's no correlation between these decelerations and mommy's contractions. It's not ominous, but it requires us to implement interventions immediately. And essentially what we do is we change mommy's position right away. We give oxygen and we assess for a prolapsed cord. Now, I had a mom one time who did, that indeed did happen to her. She had these, she was actually going through early D cells really nicely, and then she went from early D cells to boom, variables, okay? And it was just, we were watching her on the monitor, and she went from nice early D cells, you know, right away to variables. We went in to check, and when we went to look at in her vaginal area, there was this nice shiny white cord that was hanging out and was the baby's umbilical cord. Okay, it had slipped out. So we called the doctor. I had to cover the umbilical cord with some sterile gauze that was soaked in sterile normal saline. And essentially, I was picking up the umbilical cord because I wanted to relieve the pressure. Ended up throwing her on the stretcher with me sitting between her legs, okay, holding onto this umbilical cord, and we're going off to the OR this way. So. Now, we do not like fetal distress. I don't like babies when they cry, except when they're born. When they're born, I want them to cry all the time because it tells me their lungs are nice and healthy. With fetal distress, that means the fetal heart rate is unstable. What we don't like is to see fetal heart rates dropping like to the 110s, okay? We don't like it. 120 to 160, we really, really like. Over 160, well, temporarily is okay, but we don't like it to stay up there either. Okay, we don't like those kinds of things because it signals problems. Another sign of fetal distress is meconium. If the baby is born, I mean, when the rupture of membranes occurs and there's meconium, okay, then sometime, somewhere along the line in that pregnancy, the baby suffered some form of distress because that's the only time that he will pass out meconium. Okay, so if there's meconium, that means the baby was in distress some, and that's a problem because why? He could have aspirated meconium, right? So we have to get respiratory therapy there at the birth. If that happens, I mean, then the prolapse cord is the third thing also that we're going to talk about. And if that happens, you're going to cover it, like I said, and prepare for emergency C-section. All right, let's talk about the passageway. The passageway is the shape and measurement of the maternal pelvis in relation to the birth process. The passageway, let's talk about engagement. Engagement is when the presenting part of the fetus enters the pelvis. It's now station zero. It is engaged. The station is how far that presenting part has descended into the pelvis. At zero, then the presenting part here is at the ischial spine. A positive number means below that ischial spine. That means it's going down. A negative number means it's above and it hasn't really engaged yet. Okay, the cervix stretches and dilates to allow for the fetus to pass through the vagina. And a lot of us don't even know how we did it. Okay, here are the powers that project Powers are the forces that expel the fetus. Okay, this little kid is with the parachute. Hurry up and come on out, kid. Just don't do that parachute thing. How do you tell the difference between true labor contractions and, say, Braxton Hicks? Well, with true labor, these contractions will increase in frequency and intensity and duration, and they will actually cause dilation. So she will dilate. Okay, it's generally about one centimeter per hour. That's generally it on a primip. The frequency, as I said, is the beginning of one contraction to the next. The intensity is the strength of the contraction, so you measure the height of it. And the duration is the beginning of one contraction to the end of that same contraction. There are three stages of labor. There's stage one, which is the onset of contractions until full cervical dilation and effacement. That can take up of the cervix. That can take up to 24 hours in primips. In stage one, you've got three phases. You've got the latent phase, the active phase, and the transition. Okay, let's talk about the latent phasing. Latent phasing, you go from 0 to 3 centimeters, mild contractions, you know, every 5 minutes to 30 minutes, mommy's walking, she's joking, she's having a wonderful time, she's giggling and laughing, etc., right? This is fine, life is good, life is wonderful, it's only 10 to 30 seconds, and it feels like a mild menstrual cramp. Okay, so what do we do in this particular stage? Well, okay, we assess the fetal heart tones, we check the vital signs, and it says here we give fluids and carbs, so in real life, we don't give them anything. In the active phase, well, she's now going from 4 to 7 centimeters. The contractions are now every 3 to 5 minutes, and they're moderate. They're still tolerable. Okay, she's still handling it pretty well. Got contractions lasting between 30 to 45 seconds. Okay, Lamaze is working. Lamaze is working. Rhythmic breathing, yeah, it's working so far. Okay. You know, she has her focal point, and she's looking at her focal point, and her husband is right by her side, and she thinks, oh, this is such a wonderful experience, and I am just so ready for this baby. Okay. And so what do we do in this stage? Well, we monitor fetal heart tones, and if there's any pain, we might give a little Stadol. And at this point in time, she's NPO or maybe ice chips. Like I said, in real life, nothing, right? Nothing. From the second she walks in labor, you don't get nothing, baby. You get an IV. That's what you get. Okay, in the transition phase, it is now every 2 to 3 minutes. It is strong. It is lasting from 45 to 60 seconds. You see behavioral changes. Look what you did to me. Don't touch me. We have to assess fetal heart tones. You're going to stay with the mother and help her. You have to reassure the father. No, she doesn't hate you. She really doesn't hate you. This happens to everyone. And you want to discourage pushing. This is the time when she says, can't you just reach in and pull it out? Yes? Yeah, this is the time. No, we can't do that. This is the time also when she, you know, she walked in. Right, when she first walked in, oh, I'm going to do it natural. I'm going to give it do it natural. All right, guess what? This is the time when she goes, epidural, I want my epidural, give it to me right now. Come on, hurry up. quick, here. Okay. She wants that epidural, let me tell you. Anything, you give her anything, she'll take it. She will take it. Now, we'll see those nerve blocks, but we don't see that so very much anymore. But if she does go on an epidural, she cannot be more than 6 centimeters dilated. Can't do that. And you need to tell her that if she gets an epidural, it'll slow down the labor process a little bit. We'll have to monitor for hypotension. Okay, and we'll just have to, so she, at this point, she doesn't care though. You know, you give her the epidural and life is wonderful, right? She is a totally different person now. If you give an epidural, you have to tell her that she has to get about 500 cc's to 1,000 cc's of fluid, IV, before we can actually start the epidural. Stage two of labor. Stage two of labor is full dilation and effacement to the birth of the baby. So now she's 10 centimeters and she's 100% effaced. Okay, and so it goes from that period of time until the baby is actually born. What you're going to see here is the progressive descent of the baby's head. You'll see a perineal bulge, And you may see some crowning also. When you start seeing hair, okay, when you start seeing hair, then it's time to push. Before that, you don't push. Okay, when you see hair, you push. Okay, and we usually go, mommy's hair is black, daddy's hair is black, red hair. Okay. Not a problem. What are some of your interventions here? And here we got stage two, where you're going to help the mom with pushing. You're going to get ready to suction the baby. You're going to assist with delivery of the shoulders of the baby, and you may have to catheterize the mommy also, because remember, she doesn't feel it anymore. And point of fact, if you catheterize it, get ready for a precip delivery. Sometimes that can happen, because it's the full bladder that's blocking the baby from coming out. And once you catheterize and take out, you know, 1,000 cc's that she has in there, because remember, she's getting all this IV fluid, right? You catheterize, you get all the fluid out, baby comes pop right out. So you want to get ready to catheterize the mommy. Okay, the placenta. Well, the placenta is something that you got to look at after the baby's born. It may cause a problem if it's not implanted correctly or if it's calcified. It starts to calcify over 40 weeks. Some docs will let them go 42 weeks and then they'll actually deliver and they'll induce or they'll do C-sections. Okay? Stage, and with the placenta, what you've got to do is look at it too after it's born, because you have to look at both sides. The fetal side is the Schulte side, okay, the shiny side, and the maternal side is the Duncan side or the dirty side. So you're going to have one side that's kind of dull and one side that's real shiny. Okay, so you got to look at the placenta to make sure that it was a healthy placenta, because if it wasn't a healthy placenta, then you might end up having to send the placenta for a biopsy and then watching the baby and the mom a little bit more. Okay, baby was born. All right, after the baby was born, how do you know when the placenta is going to be delivered? Well, you'll actually see the abdomen kind of become a big old glob like this. Okay, it contracts up like that. Okay, the abdomen just contracts up, and then you'll see a gush of blood coming from the vagina, and then that placenta, the umbilical cord that's attached to the placenta, there's this little bit of a lengthening. And this is when the doctor generally gives it a gentle tug, and out comes the placenta. Okay, you want to make sure the placenta is intact, like I said. Stage four is the immediate postpartum period, and this is when your job is to assess fundal firmness. So you got to massage that fundus, massage that fundus, massage the fundus. And it's not comfortable, but it does help because it helps with the involution of that fundus. You want to also document what? The color of the lochia. Remember, your lochia has to go from rubra to serosa to alba. And as long as it's progressing in this fashion, you're fine. If it goes backwards, you're in trouble. There was a 32-year-old woman, she was an attorney in West Palm Beach, who presented to the ER. She had just given birth 2 weeks before to twins. Okay, she showed up in the ER because she had a sudden episode of vaginal bleed. She had went from rubra to serosa to alba. And then she suddenly had an episode of vaginal bleed, which she thought was just a period, but then the cramps occurred. Then the cramps came. So she showed up in the ER. Her husband wasn't even with her. She just drove herself in to the ER. She had retained placental fragments, and she ended up dying. Yeah, she ended up dying, not from the hemorrhaging, but she threw these microemboli. She went into DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation, and she ended up dying. So just remember, rubra, okay, serosa, alba, that's good. If it goes backwards, that is not good. You also want to tell them that you're going to make them a nice little ice pack to put in the perineum, because you know it's going to be very sore. Because they either had an episiotomy, or if they didn't have an episiotomy, you know, they just delivered a baby, they might have a laceration. Okay, so just tell them, you're going to give them ice. You're also going to encourage the bonding. The bonding process is very, very important. You're also going to check the blood pressure for postpartum PIH, particularly if she had it beforehand. And it would be nice to know this right beforehand. Your psychological response is very simple. It simply is, would you agree with me if I say that the better prepared you are for an experience, the better able you're going to be to participate in it, right? So the more information that you give them, your patients, the better off they are going to be. Somewhere out there, says this guy, I know that there's a girl for me, but where or where can she be? He's scouring the heavens, isn't he? Mom, Dad, I found her. She's the one for me. She cooks. She's a great dancer. She's intelligent. She loves kids. But most importantly, she loves me. Oh, isn't that nice? He's got, oh, yeah. She is my princess, and I want you to meet her, Mommy and Daddy. The happy day arrives, and this is, yeah, you like this? It's wedding day. Bottle of champagne. 1 year later, here she is. I've lost my toes, and it's okay. Okay? All right. You know they're going to give birth. They're going to have the, this is the first baby, so they got to do the Lamas thing, right? We got to do the Lamas thing. So, okay, is it pant, pant, blow, blow, or is it blow, blow, pant, pant? Anybody know? No, but somewhere along the line, that's the Lamas thing. You got to do this thing, all right? And here it is one day, and suddenly, oops, uh-oh, there's something running down my leg, so either I peed my pants or my water broke. So, honey, get the bag, call the doctor, and don't forget my focal point. So I think this is it, honey. There they go. They're running off to the hospital now. This is it. This is it? Please don't tell me to blow through it. It hurts. What focal point? Where's my epidural? And what do you mean I'm only 3 centimeters? I've been contracting for hours. Look what you did to me. Isn't this it? Sure it is. Yes. And we're all identifying so far. I want my knight in shining armor. Where is he? Okay, you promised me that you would never let anything bad happen to me. Yes, where is my knight in shining armor? Yeah, we're all identifying so far. Okay, guys, any guys you're identifying? I can't take it anymore. Can't you just pull it out? Is it over? Is it over? Oops, oops. Okay, oh, my baby, isn't he beautiful? Aw, life is better. It's all over now, right? Or is it? No, it's not. No, it's not. Postpartum blues occur now. But postpartum blues, you tell, this is the same mom that said she was going to go natural. She is not going to have postpartum blues, not her. She's going to be the most perfect mother and the most perfect woman. You just wait and see. And my answer is, yeah, sure. She is so exhausted, so is Dad. She wants to go to sleep, but she doesn't know. Is the baby asleep? There goes the epidural. All of a sudden, the pain comes back, especially down the perineum. She is starving now. So now she says, what do you mean I can't get out of bed without help? What do you mean I got to sleep with my baby in the bed? You know she can't get out of bed without help the first time, right? She needs your help because just in case she has this postural hypotension. She says, what do you mean I can't? What do you mean I can't sleep with my baby in the bed? What do you mean I can't prop the bottle? Why am I so weak? She doesn't get it. I'm hungry. There goes the epidural. Everything is wrong now. So now she says, please don't lie to me. I don't feel like a Madonna. Please don't tell me that I look like her when I know for a fact that I look like her. Life is awful. Life is not good. Okay? So your mission now as nurses, you have a mission impossible. So your job, should you choose to accept it, is to overthrow a small nation's insane ruler and reestablish sanity. And the State Department and your hospital will deny any knowledge of your existence should you fail or get caught. And this tape self-destructs in 5 seconds. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. So how do you do this? How do you reestablish sanity? How do you do it? Well, you know she's got a lot of problems. She hurts. She can't pee properly. She's constipated. I'm walking like a duck. My milk won't come in. My breasts hurt. Everything hurts. Everything's wrong. So what is your job? Well, your job is to help her through this. This is how you help her establish her sanity. This is postpartum, and guess what? We all go through it. No matter how much we say to ourselves, we're not going to go through it, we're going to. Every single one of us goes through a certain amount of this postpartum blues to certain extent. Okay, some less than others, but certainly we all do it. So here's weathering the storm. Okay, this is the challenge for the nurses. How do we do it? Well, we help her by checking the fundus, right? We want to reestablish everything, bring her back to normal. So we establish the, we massage the fundus. We check that episiotomy. Basically, what are we doing? We are fussing around her, aren't we? We are fussing around her because right now she thinks everything is wrong. I can't pee. No, I'm constipated. I'm walking like a duck. Everything hurts. So when you go in and you give her all this TLC, what are you doing? You're telling her you care. You're telling her that there's somebody here who cares. And we understand. We understand this. And we're checking her lochia. And we're checking her urine output and her breasts. And we're giving her warm compresses if she's breastfeeding. And we're giving her cold compresses if she's deciding not to feed. We're doing pericare on her. And we're teaching her how to do pericare. And we're teaching her a lot of things. Okay? This doesn't just go away in spite of what we do. In spite of everything that we do to help mom, it doesn't go away right away. Dad is now confused because he doesn't know what's going on. Hormonal changes occur and they affect her moods. And he thought, what is this? You know, he can't get it. He thinks his wife is going nuts. He thinks maybe he's going nuts. So now you need to get help for them all. Now, you may need to call social work. Sometimes you need to do that. But a lot of times you call pastoral care. You know, their pastor, their minister, their rabbi, whoever. You get the help for them that they need because they're going to need this to weather the storm. All right, so got that? We're all happy. Now let's go on to some more serious issues. All right, nobody's allowed to smile for the next hour. Okay. Let's talk about some complications of pregnancy. Yesterday, I did not cover hepatitis because I said I was going to do more today. So we're going to talk about hepatitis. We're going to talk a little bit more about PIH, HIV, and drug abuse. What is hepatitis? Well, hepatitis is a viral infection, and it lives in the viral infection in the liver. It's not in your book. It is not in your book. Don't wrestle. Okay? This is where you need to get pen and paper and write. Hepatitis is a viral infection. It affects the liver. You may or may not have prodromal syndromes. And what's a prodromal syndrome? Well, a prodromal syndrome is, you know, generalized malaise, a little fever, okay, a little kind of nothing. That's a prodromal syndrome, little ache and pain. Hepatitis is a major cause of death in third world countries, and I'm talking all the hepatitis put together. It can occur at any time during the pregnancy, and you may or may not have jaundice with hepatitis. And I did say that yesterday, that you may or may not, have jaundice in the pregnancy. Jaundice with hepatitis, okay? It can occur, though, at any time during the pregnancy. All right, we've got some generalized hepatitis symptoms. And we talked about prodromal earlier, okay, and we talked about, I'll go back, prodromal symptoms are just the generalized malaise kinds of things. The achy, you know, the aches, the pains, okay, the flu-like symptomology, those are prodromal. With hepatitis, remember it's itis, you see hepatitis, so it's itis at the end. So what are you seeing there for? It's an inflammation, isn't it? You can also see some form of arthralgias, and what's that? Pain in the joints. You can sometimes see rashes. You might see light stools and dark urine. And why is that? Because of the bili, right? The bilirubin. Okay, it's bilirubin that causes your stool to become black. But if there's a blockage somewhere where the bilirubin cannot get to your intestine, then the bile or the bilirubin stays in your bloodstream and it turns your urine dark and therefore your stools stay light. Your liver function tests are going to be abnormal. You may have jaundice. You may be anorexic. You might see nausea and vomiting and some abdominal pain. Those are generalized hepatitis symptoms. Hepatitis A. Now, we had a lot of questions about Hep A, all right? And the major thing that the one thing you have to understand is with hepatitis A is a fecal-oral disease. It is transmitted in the fecal-oral route. So essentially what that means is that anyone who plays in doo-doo has a chance of getting hepatitis A. Okay, I'm using that very lightly. But a daycare worker, A daycare worker is more at risk for getting hepatitis A than, say, a nurse, even though nurses clean patients, don't we? We have patients that have diarrhea, but the daycare worker is more at risk. Why? Because we're smart enough to utilize universal precautions, and we use gloves when we clean. Yeah? A daycare worker, when she changes diapers, doesn't wear gloves. She just changes the diaper with her hands. And we hope she washes her hands well afterwards. We can only hope. She may not. Have you seen those people that turn the water on, run the fingers underneath the water, and that's it? Yes. Okay, so the fecal oral route is spread by, again, somehow contaminating, getting the contamination into your system, and it usually that contamination usually comes from the stool. It can also come from contaminated shellfish. So therefore, a restaurant worker who is also very susceptible to hepatitis A. The outbreaks of hepatitis A generally occur in the winter and in the spring. Again, you've got flu-like symptoms on this one. There is no carrier state for hepatitis A, and it used to be we did not have a vaccine for it, but we do now. It's something called Havrix, and it's only good for 1 year. So we generally tell people who are traveling to third world countries that have poor sanitation to go ahead and get this Havrix vaccination. How do you diagnose hepatitis A? Well, there's a positive IgM with an anti-HAV, which is the virus. Okay, you have an antibody for the HAV. That's how you diagnose it, hepatitis A virus. All right? Hepatitis B. Hep B is bloodborne. It can also be transmitted sexually. It is asymptomatic in most patients, and it can be severe. The outbreaks of hepatitis B occur all year round, and it can last anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks to 6 months. There's no problem for the pregnant mom with hepatitis B, but there's a big problem for the newborn. So generally what happens when you have a baby born to the mother of a hepatitis B patient, that baby is going to get three injections. You know, when the baby is born under normal circumstances, what do we give them? We give them vitamin K, yes? We also do what? Vitamin K, we put drops, the emicin in the eyes, yes? With hepatitis B, if the mom is positive hepatitis B, what we do is we give the baby also hepatitis B vaccine, the first one, and we also give him hepatitis B immunoglobulin. So we give him HBIG in one leg, and we give him the hepatitis B vaccine, the first shot, in the other leg. Okay, so that is something that we have to do for the babies. Hepatitis C is another hepatitis, and you all thought that was just couple. Hepatitis C is another one, and this one NCLEX likes to ask you questions on as well. Hepatitis C is transmitted parenterally, so through IV use. It can also be transmitted through multiple blood transfusions. There is some occupational exposure, and that essentially means that we are. Anyone who has a exposure to blood and blood products is susceptible to hepatitis C. So that means healthcare professionals, we are more at risk for hepatitis C. You can get hepatitis C sexually, but that's to a lesser extent. The people more at risk, again, are people who are exposed to blood and blood products. There is no vaccine against hepatitis C. Now, what we found out is there's a large, large population of Vietnam veterans who have come down with hepatitis C. Now, we don't really know why. We can't put the blame 100% on drug use in Vietnam, because a lot of these people were actually out in the boondocks and out in the front lines, but they had no ability to get any drugs. So what we're thinking is that, there's a multiple exposure to blood. I mean, it's a lot of death there, and people were wounded and stuff. So we're thinking that that's probably it. Okay. It can take up to 1 year to become evident, hepatitis C. Actually, it can take longer than that. I just had a friend who was diagnosed 3 years ago with hepatitis C from some very foolish practices that he engaged in when he was a much younger person, and he's now 46. All right, hepatitis E. hepatitis E is found in sewage contaminated water. It's pretty prevalent in developing countries, and there's a very high mortality rate in developing countries as far as pregnant women are concerned. There is no vaccine for hepatitis E. How do you rule out hepatitis E, or how do you find out if it's hepatitis E? You rule out all the others, and then you know it's hepatitis E. Hepatitis D, this is the one that NCLEX likes to ask you on. It's a defective virus, and it occurs with Hep B. In other words, you can only get Hep D if you have Hep B. So if you have hepatitis B, then they will test you for hepatitis D. But you cannot get hepatitis D without having hepatitis B. Okay, so you must have hepatitis B first. Hepatitis D can be spread through sexual contact, through blood and blood products. Okay, and how do we diagnose it? Well, we diagnose it because you will carry the antibody of the hepatitis D virus. It occurs absolutely worldwide. And you can prevent hepatitis D by getting the hepatitis B vaccines. Because remember, if you don't have Hep B, you can't get Hep D, right? So we prevent hepatitis D by ensuring that people get the Hep Vac. There is no cure for hepatitis D. What are the odds? What are the chances of baby getting hepatitis B? This is what we're most concerned with as far as pregnant women are concerned. Yes. Can I go back to E for a minute? Yes, I can. There you go. Sewage contaminated water is where it's found. It's found in developing countries. There's a high mortality rate with pregnant women. There's no vaccine for Hep E. And the way you diagnose hepatitis E is you rule out all the other hepatitis. Let's go. What are the odds of the baby getting hepatitis B? Well, if a pregnant woman has the surface antigen of hepatitis B at the time of the birth, then she is positive for hepatitis B regardless of the symptoms. You don't have to copy this down because this is not something that NCLEX is going to question you on. I just want you to understand it, all right? Basically, they want you to know what to do with the baby that is born to hepatitis B mom, but I figured that if you understand a little bit beyond, then you won't forget. If a pregnant woman has a surface antigen, then she has then the chances of her transmitting the disease to her baby is 20 to 25%. If she's got the surface antigen and the core antigen, HBeAg is the core antigen, it lives in the nucleus. So if she's got the surface antigen and the core antigen at the time of birth, then the risk of perinatal transmission jumps to 90 to 95%. So essentially what we've got to do is know that the baby has a pretty high risk, right, chance of getting hepatitis B, and hepatitis B in a baby can be fatal. So we've got to take care of the baby, okay? This is what we're going to do for the baby. Remember I told you we're going to give the hepatitis B vaccine? We're also going to give the HBIG, all right? So if the mom is hepatitis B positive, this you want to copy down. If mom is hepatitis B positive, then you're going to give the hepatitis V vaccine to the baby, the first shot within 12 hours of the birth. At the same time, in the other leg, you're going to give HBIG. I'll say this one more time. If the mommy is positive HBV, which is hepatitis B, then within 12 hours of the birth, you want to give the first shot of the hepatitis B vaccine to the baby. In the other thigh, you're going to give the HBIG, which is the immunoglobulin. What the HBIG does is it confers immediate passive immunity to the baby. Immediate passive immunity. And it lasts for like 2 to 3 months. And that gives the HBV vaccine that you're giving a chance to kick in to take care of the baby. Follow? So we're going to give immediate immunity with the HBIG. Okay? And then by the time the HBIG wears off, the HBV, which is the other series of three vaccines, will kick in. First shot for the vaccine, the HBV vaccine, is within 12 hours of birth. Okay? Then it's at 1 month after that, and then 6 months after that. Got it? So it's at birth, at 1 month, and then at 6 months. Okay? That's what you want to know. All right. What's your nursing responsibility? What is your nursing responsibility to a mom that you know is positive HPV? Avoid as many invasive procedures as possible during the labor. Okay, the other thing is that you want to know is that the mom really can't breastfeed. So do not put the baby to breast. Okay, please don't do that. You want to maintain the integrity of the fetal skin as much as possible. So what we ask you to do is before you give any injections to the baby, you bathe the baby first. This is the one time where we tell you don't give that vitamin K shot immediately. You need to stabilize the baby under the warmer, the incubator. Bathe him first. Why? Because you want to get all that amniotic fluid off him, all that vernix off him. Why? Because that's all contaminated, isn't it? Yeah, it's contaminated by mommy's HPV virus. So you want to just clean him off completely and then go ahead and give him his shots. Okay, this is the one time where we ask you to just wait. And you want to really maintain the integrity of that fetal skin. You don't need to separate mommy from baby, but no breastfeeding for at least 48 hours until 48 hours after the HBIG has been given. Why? You want to give that baby the passive immunity first before you let mommy breastfeed. Because you don't want the baby to get any more of the viral load of hepatitis B. So you just wait. The other thing that you want to do is strict isolation for the baby until after the complete bath. This means daddy doesn't pick up, Aunt Tilly doesn't pick up the baby, Cousin Jane doesn't pick up the baby. Okay, it doesn't mean strict isolation in the sense that you kick everybody out of the room. But it means nobody picks up the baby until after the baby's been bathed. So strict isolation for baby until after the baby has been given a bath. And no breastfeeding for at least 48 hours after the HBIG has been given. Did you all get this? But do you all understand the principle behind why you don't wait? I mean, why you wait until after you've bathed the baby before you give any injections? You just don't want to introduce anything else into the kid. Okay, so that's your reasoning. All right, let's talk about diabetes. Again, real quickly. Remember I said every diabetic patient, whether it's type 1 or type 2, will get insulin. We don't give oral hypoglycemics to pregnant women ever, ever, ever. Okay, some of the labs that we perform, glycosylated hemoglobin, the glucose tolerance test also. After the baby's born, we have to watch the mom and the baby, right, for the blood sugar. Okay, here's what we do. Here's what we do for diabetic moms and for babies born of diabetic moms. Between the 28th and the 32nd week, we start doing non-stress tests weekly or bi-weekly. In the first trimester, we do an ultrasound. In the second trimester, we do another ultrasound. In the third trimester, we do another ultrasound. That's three ultrasounds, okay? In the 28th week, we start teaching the mom how to do kick counts. You know what that is? She has a clock, and she times how many kicks the baby kicks in an hour. Yeah, so we have to teach her how to do kick counts. Between 28 to 32 weeks, we also send her through oxytocin challenge tests or non-stress tests. And then at 32 to 34 weeks, we send her for a biophysical profile, which is another ultrasound, another measurement of amniotic fluid, so we do a lot of stuff for this little baby. Okay, so why are we doing all of this? We do Doppler flows at 34 weeks. Why are we doing all this? Because we want to get this kind of output. We want this kind of picture, a nice, happy baby. Okay, that's why. This is a baby to a diabetic mom, so this baby's going to have a lot of problems if we don't do something to prevent. Okay, postpartally, we want to check the blood sugars, as I said. And you follow the hospital policy. Some hospitals, it's every 15 times. Actually, there's one hospital I know, it's every 15 times 4, then it's 30 times 2, and then it's 1 times 2, every 1 hour times 2. So, again, it kind of depends on your hospital policy. Okay, if it's a type 1 diabetic, if the mom was an insulin-dependent diabetic, okay, she will be on an insulin drip during her labor. She will be on one. Okay, so right after she gives birth, you want to reduce the insulin infusion by one half. Okay, and then you continue with IV D5 infusion until she starts eating and drinking. If it's a gestational diabetic, then you stop the insulin infusion immediately postpartum. Okay, so here's your difference. Insulin dependent, you just reduce by half, the insulin drip by half, and you continue the IV D5.5 until she starts eating and drinking. If she has gestational diabetes, then you stop the insulin immediately postpartum. You will ultimately wean her. If she's type 1, you'll ultimately wean her off the insulin, but that includes AccuChecks and all sorts of things. Okay, and the doctor will generally work with you on that one. This is the blood sugar monitoring. Like I said, different hospitals have different protocols. This is another protocol. You do the blood sugar at birth, then you do the blood sugar at 30 minutes of life, then the first hour of life, the second hour of life, and the fourth hour of life. So each facility does change. In South Florida, this is what we did, blood sugar at birth, then at 30 minutes, then at first hour of life, second hour of life, and third hour of life. Like I said, there's another hospital that goes a little bit further, but that's probably because they have a high-risk area. So, all right, insulin does not cross into the breast milk. So this is one question that NCLEX likes to ask you. Can a diabetic mom breastfeed? The answer is yes, because insulin does not cross into the breast milk. The mother has a risk for hypoglycemia, so you've got to watch her very carefully. Remember, right after birth, her hormone levels that were very high start bottoming out now. And remember that estrogen in and of itself is a natural, diabetogenic. In other words, it encourages the production of sugar. So estrogen encourages the production of sugar. It's a natural diabetogenic. Okay, so during pregnancy, with that increase in estrogen, she's also just producing more glucose. So right after birth, that estrogen level just bottoms out. So because it bottoms out, it's hard for the pancreas to just very quickly adjust like that. She has a risk for hypoglycemia. Remember I told you about the toxemia belt? North and South Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi. Oh, I forgot Missouri. Yep. Pica is very common in this place, and although we don't have any research supporting the relationship between pica and PIH, we do have some research correlating high fried food and salt and pica and a PIH. Some, but it's still not definitive. Because we tell people who have PIH or who have a susceptibility to PIH to reduce their sugar, salt. We say no added salt, but we really don't tell them to cut it out completely. Okay? Hypertension that occurs in pregnancy is a leading cause of maternal, fetal and neonatal mortality, and you've got some classifications. You've got the PIH, pregnancy-induced hypertension. It's transient. It can be transient, it can be preeclamptic, or it can be eclamptic. If it's preeclamptic, then it can be in the mild form or the severe form. And what makes it severe? It's those headaches, right? The epigastric pain, right? And if you have a patient who has mild pain headache or epigastric pain, what are you going to do? Call the doctor. This is because you don't want her to get to the eclamptic stage. Okay, there's also chronic hypertension. And there are women who become, who are taking antihypertensives during their entire pregnancy. There's pregnancy-aggravated hypertension. There's a woman I know whose blood pressure just stays in the 180s over 100s. And she just, she likes being pregnant. This is her sixth child. And she has, she has a high risk of superimposed preeclampsia or superimposed eclampsia. So she actually, we have to monitor her blood pressures very carefully during her pregnancy. This woman does not make monthly visits. She makes weekly visits throughout her whole entire pregnancy. Okay, some fetal risks with pregnancy-induced hypertension. Intrauterine growth retardation, or IUGR. Abruptio placenta. Can you just understand why abruptio placenta can occur? That high blood pressure can just pull that placenta away. Yes? Fetal distress, preterm labor, that's another one. Low birth weight. Low birth weight certainly is a major complication with pregnancy-induced hypertension. And this low birth weight can cause perinatal morbidity and mortality as well. When you're caring for a patient with hypertension, be prepared for the delivery of a high-risk baby. Okay, let's talk about some predisposing factors to preeclampsia. Someone who's young and who's pregnant for the first time. Someone who's young It's a second pregnancy, but it's a different father. Anyone with a history of chronic hypertension or renal disease, twin gestations, diabetes mellitus, any history of preeclampsia, anyone who is black and over 35, anyone with collagen vascular disease. Those are your predisposing factors to preeclampsia. With preeclampsia, it used to be that we required proteinuria or edema. It's no longer completely true. Okay, significant proteinuria should be based upon a 24-hour collection, 24-hour urine collection. 2+ or 300 milligrams or more are considered significant. Significant. All right, here's a case study. June A is a 25-year-old primip, and she presents with a chief complaint of aches and pains. She is 16 weeks pregnant and states that her fingers have become so swollen in the last 3 days that she can't get her rings off, and that when she woke up this morning, her vision was momentarily blurry. June also says that she's not been able to eat over the past week due to an increased sensation of nausea and pain just above her umbilicus. What would you expect to do with June? First of all, what are the problems that you notice with June? Let's go from her fingers have become so swollen in the last 3 days, she cannot get her rings off. Remember I said upper body edema is a problem. So that's problem number one. What's problem number two? Blurred vision, that's number two. What's number three? Epigastric discomfort, right? Yes, she has been unable to eat over the past week due to an increased sensation of nausea and pain just above her umbilicus. So what would you expect to do with her? What do you think she may be presenting with? Pregnancy-induced hypertension, right? So what would you expect to do? Well, first of all, you do bed rest, don't you? You put her on bed rest. You start an IV on her. Okay, because most likely the doctor wants to give her something to bring that blood pressure down. Okay, here's another. And what else would you see being given? Something like labetalol, which could bring her blood pressure down. Okay, labetalol, you can give IV. All right? Those are the sorts of things that you would see. Okay, here's another case study. Marie L. is an 18-year-old G2 T0 P0 A2 L0. Okay, so gravid at 2, she's been pregnant twice. No term births, no premature births, 2 abortions, and no live births. She's 5 feet tall and weighs 185 pounds. She presents with a chief complaint of amenorrhea by times 5 months. She has not been seen by any physician and has no insurance. Vital signs on admission include a blood pressure of 180 over 96, and she denies blood pressure problems. Pre-pregnancy, she actually doesn't know if she's pregnant or not. What would you expect to see on her treatment plan? Okay, she doesn't know, right? 5 feet tall, weighs 185 pounds. Vital signs, okay, we've got some problems. One is the height-weight ratio, okay? Then she has amenorrhea for 5 months, so that she might be pregnant. We don't know. She might be pregnant. She also has an admission blood pressure of 180 over 96. So what would you expect to see on her plan? Well, I would just go ahead and, again, put her on bed rest. I'd have to monitor her blood pressure, you know, just to make sure that she doesn't have PIH. We would also do a urine pregnancy test, right, a UPT. We'll do a urine pregnancy test, make sure she's not pregnant. Okay, now I got a nice story for you. This woman shows up in the ER, she's in the triage, okay, and she is got a real nice belly here. Okay, we got some pregnant women here. Got a real nice belly here. And I said, okay, what can I help you with? She says, I think I'm pregnant. Okay. You think, what makes you think you're pregnant? Well, I haven't had a period in 3 months. I'm thinking, my gosh, if this is 3 months pregnant, geez, my knees, you know, what is she carrying in there? Okay. Well, let me tell you what. She was actually 9 months pregnant. She was in labor, okay, and she had had Zippo, no prenatal care, none, clearly, because she shows up now, I think I'm pregnant. And what was your first clue that you were pregnant? So we take her upstairs and she gives birth. Yeah, there you go. Okay? A 3-month-old baby and it weighed 7 pounds, 8 ounces. Ooh. Imagine if she'd carried it to term. Okay. How do you manage preeclamptic women? Well, you manage them, number one, by preventing convulsions with the use of mag sulfate, right? So we know about mag sulfate because we know that we're going to have to monitor reflexes, yes, monitor blood pressure, monitor respirations, yes, absolutely monitor respirations with mag sulfate. We're also going to ensure adequate kidney function, and we're going to do electronic fetal monitoring for any signs of uterine placental insufficiency. We also want to stabilize that woman until delivery, because we don't want any problems to happen. Now, how many of you have heard of this? It's called the HELP syndrome. HELP syndrome, H stands for hemolysis, EL stands for elevated liver enzymes, and LP stands for low platelets. This is a syndrome that can occur with PIH, okay, with eclampsia, preeclampsia, all right? You can go into HELP syndrome. When HELP syndrome happens, guess what? You may end up with DIC, which we really don't like. We're very unhappy when DIC happens. Okay, here's another case study. You ready? I know you all like these. Your neighbor asks you if she should restrict her salt intake. You know that she's recently been diagnosed with preeclampsia. What should you tell her? No, you tell her that there has been no study to correlate salt intake with preeclampsia, but you would ask her to maybe go on a no added salt. Okay, so not to add any salt, all right? But certainly not to increase it. She can have salt in cooking with her food, but not to add any salt. So certainly, yes. Okay, what are some of the meds that we're going to see with PIH? Remember I mentioned labetalol? You might also see hydralazine being given as well. Now, you might want to copy these things down because these are antihypertensive. So this is a couple. I know that you guys are all panicking as far as pharmacology is concerned. Yeah. I see the panic in your eyes. When I say drugs, you guys go, hmm. There's panic in your eyes. Remember, just be prepared at all times. Be prepared, and you're going to have sunshine no matter what you do. Okay. Let's talk about the HIV mom. Women of childbearing age represent the fastest growing populations affected by HIV and AIDS in the world. In 1993, HIV was the fourth leading cause of death among women between the ages of 25 and 44 years of age. That's a pretty shocking statistic, isn't it? What is HIV? Well, it's a retrovirus. And when I say retrovirus, I do not mean it swims backwards. Yes, I actually had someone tell me that that's what it meant. It swims backwards. No. It means that in the replication series, okay, it goes from messenger RNA to transcriptase RNA to form DNA. It actually goes backwards. So what the virus does is it encodes what it wants into the transcriptase RNA to form a new DNA. And that's how it mutates. So it's a retrovirus in the sense that it doesn't follow the normal procedure of making DNA. It used to be called HTLV-3. It also used to be called GRID. Remember when it was gay-related immunodeficiency disease? No, you're all too young for that? Okay, no, you're not. Okay, well, anyway, in the 1980s, the late 1970s, early 1980s, HIV was discovered, and we used to call it GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency disease, because at that point in time, we found it primarily in homosexual young men. Okay, and how did we find it? Well, we found these men were presenting with something called Kaposi's sarcoma, which ordinarily is a sarcoma that appears only in Mediterranean men, middle-aged Mediterranean men. So here were these young men appearing with Kaposi's sarcoma. So it was called gay-related immunodeficiency disease. We did not know a whole heck of a lot about it. I remember my first patient who had HIV, and he was really terminal at this point in time. It had affected his brain. We put these mitts on his hands because he was always flopping his hands all the way around like this. He was totally incontinent of stool and urine. he had PCP, he had toxoplasmosis, he had everything you wanted to mention. Okay, this poor guy had it. And we didn't know how to treat him. So you know what we did? This is what we do in medicine. We don't know what's wrong. We'll put you in strict isolation. And that's exactly what we did to him. We put him in strict isolation. So when we went in to take care of him, guess what we had to do? Gown and glove from head to toe. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, from head to toe. So here we are looking like Nanook of the North, okay, and we're going in with all our gowns and gloves. And people didn't know what was causing gay-related immunodeficiency disease, so nobody wanted to take care of him. Nobody did. My very first patient, no one would take care of him, I'm telling you. No one would. I was the only one who would go into that room. And I don't know whether it was because of fear or because he just didn't want to gown and glove, you know, do the whole kit and caboodle, whatever. But no one wanted to take care of him because they were so, it was fear. That was what it was. I mean, one of them actually said, I don't want to touch him because I might become homosexual. Oh, is that how it's done? Then we discovered that, no, it was not only gay men who got HIV. Heterosexuals contracted it just as readily, okay? And it was spread by blood and blood products and by sexual contact. So that's when life became a little bit different. The HIV has a great affinity for a protein called CD4. This virus just attaches to the CD4 receptor and enters the cell. The RNA from the virus, remember I told you it's reverse, it's retro, okay, becomes incorporated into the DNA of the cell, causing that DNA to produce new viral particles that destroy the host. So it goes backwards. It just replicates itself. It puts itself into the DNA of the cell. Okay, how do we diagnose it? Well, we do the ELISA test. ELISA test is not specific. You couldn't have a false positive. You can have a false negative. And by itself, is not considered to be diagnostic. So how is the diagnosis confirmed? Well, the diagnosis is confirmed with the Western blot. We do the ELISA first because it's quick, cheap, and easy, or quicker, cheaper, and easier. And then if that's, I know I said it reverse the other. And then if that comes back and we want a confirmation, then we send it for the ELISA blot. Okay, we can also do a viral culture if we wanted to. So what actually is AIDS? Well, AIDS is caused by the HIV. It is not synonymous with HIV infection. You can have HIV and not have AIDS. All right, let's understand that. In 1993, the CDC expanded the AIDS definition to include lab evidence of infection. You have to have this. Lab evidence of infection, or lab severe evidence of severe immunosuppression, and or one or more of 26 identified clinical conditions for AIDS. We used to have only 4. Now we have 26 clinical conditions. Yeah, isn't that something? Why is that? Because that retrovirus is pretty darn smart. It just mutates all the time. So, how is HIV transmitted? Well, it can transmit horizontally and or vertically. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean standing up or laying down, okay? I know you all. Okay. So horizontally means, blood to blood transmission, sexual transmission. Okay, that's a horizontal thing. Vertical means from mommy to baby. Okay, so horizontal is blood to blood transmission, sexual transmission, that sort of thing. And vertical means mommy to baby. What is the impact of HIV on pregnant women? Premature rupture of membranes, definitely. Low birth weight, intrauterine growth retardation, hypoxia for the baby, and stillbirth. I had a mom whose baby had died in utero. We still had to induce her, and she gave birth to a dead baby. Yeah. That's the way it's done. Okay, what kinds of risks or risky behaviors put a woman at risk for HIV? Anyone who is an IV drug abuser, anyone who has multiple sex partners, Anyone who received blood transfusions between 1978 and 1985, because at that point in time we did not have the screening tool, okay, to adequately diagnose and discover if the blood, clear the blood of HIV. Multiple STDs. If you are currently living or born in an area where HIV is prevalent, so like Belgrade. Battered women are at risk for HIV, and alcoholic women are at risk for HIV. Why battered women? And why alcoholic women? Well, battered women, think about this, they're being beaten. They're being beaten by their partner. And do you honestly think that their partner is going to be sexually faithful to them? No, they're not. They're going to be out there sleeping with everyone that they want, and then they'll come back and sleep with this woman too and, you know, pass it on to her. So battered women. Another thing that you have to think about is some battered women are battered not only physically but also psychologically, and some men actually pass their women around. Yeah. So they're more at risk. Alcohol, now I want you all to think about this very carefully, okay? A lot of people think that drugs and alcohol, that if a woman is drinking or is doing drugs, then, you know, if she's beaten, oh well, she asked for it. Okay, I'm here to tell you that nobody in this whole world asks to be beaten. Nobody. And you need to flip your thinking, because it is not the alcohol and drugs that leads to being beaten. It's being beaten that leads to the drug and alcohol. The majority of women and men who are now drug abusers and who are now alcoholics had sometime in their life some form of abuse. Women who are sexually abused as a child, psychologically, physically abused as a child, tend to become drug users and tend to become alcoholics. Why? It is an escape. It is a way for them to get away from that problem. It is a way for them to just say, you know, if I get drunk enough or high enough, I won't feel the pain. So flip that thinking around and think a little bit differently. Women who come to the ER a lot and who present with these abdominal pains, a little back pains, you know what? Ask them if they feel safe at home. Chances are they're being beaten. Chances are they are. 1 out of 3 women in their adult life will be either psychologically or physically abused. 1 out of 3. So look around you in this room, 1 out of 3. It crosses all socioeconomic barriers. If you are pregnant, your risk of getting beaten increases 25% to 35%. In point of fact, about 35% of pregnant women are beaten. So it has now become a sociological problem. And that's where this comes in to the whole thing about labor and delivery with pregnant women. Pregnant women are more likely to be beaten. Now, why am I stressing this? Well, 2 reasons. Number one is that NCLEX has begun to ask questions about this. That's number one, okay? And number two, it's really important that in our life we understand the phenomenon of abuse. We need to practice universal precautions with every single woman or every single person that we see. The majority of healthcare workers who have tested positive for HIV have either experienced needle sticks or have had extensive contact with blood or blood products without universal precautions. Now, it is pretty rare that you can contract HIV from a needle stick, but it does happen. So it's very important that you do practice universal precautions. You don't recap your needles, please. Don't recap your needles. I know some places say a one-hand scoop is okay, but as far as NCLEX is concerned, you don't recap your needles. Okay, as far as your life is concerned, don't recap your needles, unless you're real good at the one-hand thing. Okay, fortunately, in most places, you just dump it somewhere and it just goes away. Okay, remember that seroconversion usually occurs 6 to 12 weeks after the infection, but can occur as late as 6 to 14 months after exposure. So what does that mean? It means that for the first 6 to 12 weeks, or up to 14 months, okay, that person may very well be asymptomatic, but may be infective. That's that window right there, folks. Maybe, you know, may not have any symptoms at all. So as far as infection control for the infant is concerned, you need to avoid invasive procedures, and you need to avoid extended exposure to potentially infected bodily fluids. That mother that I told you that was HIV positive, that decided she was going to get pregnant and going to have a baby, okay, she wanted to hold the baby and breastfeed the baby after birth. And we said, no, you can hold the baby, but you cannot breastfeed the baby. And she said, why not? I'm on AZT cocktail, and so is the baby going to be on AZT cocktail. I said, that's true, but we don't know what kind of virus you have and what mutation of virus your baby has. And while I think it's wonderful that you have a baby, I think that if you breastfeed your baby, that's irresponsible. And that is the one time I said to her, that's irresponsible, and you shouldn't do it. And, you know, she did not, because she knew I was really hot under the collar about this one. Okay, breastfeeding the baby is a no-no because the virus does cross the milk barrier, so you don't want to do that at all. You want to, for mom, reduce the exposure to opportunistic organisms, and you want to watch for signs and symptoms of infection. Okay, you want to do the group beta hepatitis, the group beta strep screen, and you want to certainly give AZT to the mom. Okay, does AZT present a threat to the baby? Right now, like I said to you all before, the studies say no, because AZT, which is also known as zidovudine, while it is effective in reducing the perinatal transmission of HIV, it's really not been associated with increases or birth defects or anything like that. Of course, we don't know, and we won't know until that kid grows up exactly what longitudinal study will show us what AZT has actually done. Okay. What is AZT? Well, just so you know, it's an antiretroviral. It interrupts viral replication, and it does cross the placental barrier. Okay, CDC recommends that they take AZT antepartum, intrapartum, postpartum, and postnatal, right? So the AZT essentially says, mommy, you start taking it before you get pregnant, while you're pregnant, while you're giving birth, where, you know, after you've given birth, and baby is going to start immediately on AZT as soon as baby is born. That's essentially what we're saying. Some of the side effects of AZT, and the reason why we say we don't know just exactly what it's going to do, is because we know that while AZT does suppress, it's an antiretroviral drug, it also has some pretty severe side effects, and one of them is bone marrow suppression. Okay, so you can have anemia or thrombocytopenia or neutropenia from it. And some of the long-term effects include sterility and myopathy, okay? And it can also be carcinogenic. So once again, we don't know. The jury is still out on AZT. It may stop the seroconversion, but what it does down the road, we honestly don't know. All right, this is the next to last slide. How is HIV diagnosed in the newborn? It's difficult to diagnose under 15 months of age because of the presence of maternal antibodies. So essentially what we do is we do the P24 antigen. It may be false positive, may be false negative. Under 15 months of age is real, real hard. Okay, and we don't do PCR anymore. We do viral cultures as well.
You have completed the Women's Health and Maternal Newborn Nursing section. Please move to the next section of the lecture series, which is pediatric nursing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.